Good afternoon to all of you. It's good to see you here on an absolutely gorgeous afternoon, first holy day, Feast of Tabernacles. As all of us are looking forward to this period being a foretaste of the world tomorrow, I hope in the evening and morning so far you've had a foretaste of the 7 days yet to come and that it's been delightful. Thursday evening, my wife, mother-in-law, and I came into the Terrebonne area, coming down to Redmond, by about 7:15. The haze was hanging on the horizon to the east, and the moon had just come over the lip of the hills. Absolutely delightful. I pointed it out to my wife. We drove along, looked at it as we were coming into Redmond. Last night, about the same time we were coming down the highway from Sisters into Redmond, looking at the same spot in the moon, and my mother and father were asking where the moon was, and I said, well, last night at this time it was, and we drove along, still didn't see the moon. By the time we got here, we were walking to the auditorium. I said, you know what, after services, it's back to the room. I'm going to have to look up those prophecies about when the moon doesn't shine and see what's next. Thankfully, by the time services were over, the moon was up and everything was fine. It's fascinating how we create certain associations, isn't it? That beautiful full moon is one of the associations that's automatic. As you and I know we're all the same, as you and I move into that last few days before the feast, we watch the moon rise, watch it moving toward its fullness, and we say the feast is just about here. That's the way we are. We have those associations. If I ask you in general, we'll do a very, very brief association game. If I were to simply say the word millennium, and ask you to create the first association that comes to mind in connection with millennium, I've got a good hunch what it would be. In fact, I've got an excellent hunch that it's going to be one of two. Last night, in fact, Mr. Walker gave both of them in his opening message. He made a comment relating to Isaiah 2 and a comment relating to Isaiah 11. Because when you and I think of millennium, the things that we think of first of all as a majority will be what's up here on the corner of the stage, a lion and a lamb. Or we're going to think of the time when people beat their swords into plowshares, their spears into pruning hooks, and war is no more learned. These are so automatic. These are associations that are intrinsic to the meaning of the Feast of Tabernacles. Now let me ask a very different question, and I want you to think of what the association mentally is to this. The 6 o'clock news. Pick your channel, I don't care, ABC, CBS, NBC, CNN, it doesn't make any difference, Fox, any of the cable stations. The 6 o'clock news. Now what runs through your mind? Well, if you watch the 6 o'clock news, I can tell you what runs through your mind. Terrorism, or war in general, crime, whatever the latest crime is at 6 o'clock in your community, weather anomalies. Well, the normal weather is not talked about. If there is something disastrous going on, weather disasters are talked about. And, of course, in all parts of the United States, but probably even more so here in western Oregon and western Washington, the economy. How many of you, and this I'm curious about, when I ask you to draw an association with the 6 o'clock news, and I may have missed some of you, how many of you, when I ask for an association, associated it with something good? Can I see your hands? Not a hand that I can see in the entire auditorium. I bought a CD, a music CD, since CDs come in different forms. I bought a music CD to service us today. It was recorded in 1983. It was it won the award of leading single and leading album in the Country Music Awards of 1984. So it was recorded in 83. But at the Country Music Awards in 1984, it won both Outstanding Single and Outstanding Album. It also, for those people that keep statistics, ended up being one of the most played songs of that decade. I've asked Chip Chaprinko on sound to play either a part of it or all of it. It's 3 minutes long. If I decide to let it run the full length of time and you get fidgety, it's 3 minutes long. If we've heard enough partway, I'll cue him and we'll go on. But I want you to hear the particular song, because it speaks to the heart of all of us, not just us here in this room. It literally speaks to the heart of the people of this nation, and it speaks to the heart of people around the world. Chip, would you go ahead and cue that up?
This morning, kiss every morning you show up. Try and tell me what's talking about the planning you left on. Some said it was talking about the bad economy. Some care what you see. Need a change of policy.
The next verse sounds the same as the first, and the chorus doesn't change. The message is quite clear. The song is 20 years old. The desire hasn't changed. It wouldn't matter whether it was 85, 95, or 205. Every single living human being would appreciate waking up one day, as the chorus of that particular song says, and finding out there was no bad news to report. We live in a world that could use a lot of good news. And at the heart level, it is a world that yearns for good news. You know, you and I have a biblical vocabulary. We use the word gospel so automatically, we probably don't stop at times to consider that the word gospel simply means good news. And the good news that gospel intended to bring started with the first coming of Jesus Christ and the fact that that made available salvation to a first fruits. But that gospel had a destination, and that destination was the kingdom of God. The destination was the time when not just a handful of people would have an open door to salvation, but when all of mankind would have a doorway to salvation. What is the best news that God has for mankind when his kingdom comes? Today I'd like to express that in one word, and that one word is peace. You know, as a nation, we tried peace, and I'd have to put that in quotes. We tried peace in the 60s and 70s. We protested the war in Vietnam. We developed a universal sign that people would flash at each other. Peace. We saw all sorts of vehicles that had bumper stickers that said, "Make love, not war." We invented Woodstock. And we gave a whole new definition to love. What did we get for all of our efforts? Well, we redefined drug abuse. From the days of our attempt at finding peace onward, we have been a nation whose drugs of choice have changed. We have changed the demographics of crime. Crime today, instead of focusing as it did in the 20s on prohibition or upon the mafia, focuses on nations like Colombia and drug lords, and the conduits for bringing those drugs into our nation. Our attempt at peace brought entire new words into our vocabulary in the category of sexually transmitted diseases. We also found that our attempt at peace created new curriculums in schools as children had to learn about alternative families because the normal nuclear family was decreasing in such numbers that people had to understand that not everybody grows up having a mother and a father. We have also introduced into our classrooms children with reduced mental capacity and learning disabilities directly related to a drug-using mother as they were being carried in the womb. We didn't do too well in the 60s and the 70s. The byproduct isn't much to crow about. The world in which we live in, whether it's the United States of America or anywhere else on the face of this earth, brethren, live with a reality. Peace in this world is at its very best. At its very best, a state of numbed consciousness. Now, if any of you think that's a rather harsh assessment of peace, consider as we go along and look at the realities of the world in which we live. You know, if I were to ask you, what is real peace? I would have to say again that we live in a world that is so far removed from the comprehension of real peace that we wouldn't know it, if we use the old saying, if it bit us. We would not know real peace if we saw it. Let's start. I'm going to walk you through what real peace is. Let's start where everyone understands. Peace is the absence of war. How much peace has man experienced in all of human history? Isaiah chapter 59. And it's interesting the number of scriptures, the great concentration of scriptures in the book of Isaiah that deal with both the absence of, the restoration of, and the consequences of both. As God inspired the prophet Isaiah to do an assessment of humanity, our nation being the focal point, but our nation as a focal point was simply a starting place, he made a character assessment of humanity. And in that character assessment of humanity, he said in Isaiah chapter 59, verse 8, "The way of peace they have not known." You want an assessment of the world in which we live? You want an assessment of its grasp and comprehension of peace? You have it in Isaiah 59 and verse 8. "The way to find it is not known by mankind." I was looking for a series of quotes from years past. searched the web and finally found a quote that many of us have heard before. I appreciated the fact that the person using it in this case also had its source. The individual said, in 1968, historians Will and Ariel Durant calculated that there had been only 268 years free of war in the previous 3,421 years. Let me read that again. Let me state it again. Historians Will and Ariel Durant, in an assessment of the last 3,421 years, said, we calculate there are only 268 of those years that were free of war. The commentator quoting the Durant said most likely they undercounted the wars. Now, the assessment was made in 1968, and the commentator said certainly there have been no years without war since. It's funny how war goes. If it's not in your neighborhood, you're not that aware of it. The European community has not seen a war since the end of World War II, longest period in their history. We have not been involved in wars of the scale of World Wars I and II since the end of World War II, although we are quite conscious of Korea and Vietnam. But most of us, because of the flourishing economy of the 80s and the 90s, probably due to our own national prosperity, are completely oblivious to the amount of war this world has suffered in the peaceful time following the end of the Cold War. The irony then is, when the Berlin Wall came down and the Eastern Bloc ended, wars increased. During the last decade of the 20th century, the 1990s, civil wars, ethnic cleansings, and acts of genocide claimed 5 million lives during the 1990s. The sad thing about the wars that are happening now is they are claiming primarily the lives of civilians. Well, the wars that have been fought on battlefields have primarily taken the lives of those who either chose to or were drafted to go to war. At the beginning of this century, as the clock rolled over from the year 2000 to 2001, at the beginning of the 21st century, there were more than 60 low and medium intensity wars raging around the planet, roughly double the average number during the Cold War. That's simply the statistics on wars. It's amazing what people determine that they will study. I was looking at a report from a group of atrocitologists. Now, those of you that are good with words don't have too much trouble understanding what they study. Atrocities. Among them were people that most of you probably have not heard of: Matthew White, Rudolf Rummel, Sharif Bassouni. One name did stand out because of his time in the cabinet of one of the American presidents, Zbigniew Brzezinski. All of these men, from different angles, tried to assess during the 1900s, from the start to the end, how many people died due to war and its related consequences. Interestingly, Matthew White, who compiled this material as a part of writing an historical atlas of the 20th century, labeled it deaths by mass unpleasantness. Now, he had to do that because each of these authorities went about creating his statistics in slightly different ways. Bassouni said in the last centuries, in the last century, as a result of war, we lost off this planet roughly 203 million people. Zbigniew Brzezinski calculated it on the basis of lives deliberately extinguished by politically motivated carnage. So he took that tack. And his summation is that it was somewhere between 167 and 175 million people. Rudolf Rommel labeled his as death by government. Democides, meaning government-inflicted deaths, wars, and non-democidal famine, meaning the famines that followed in the wake of war. And he said, I believe there are about 258 million people who have died during the last 100 years. Matthew White, author of the brief, categorized it as deaths by mass unpleasantness. And he calculated about 188 million people during the 20th century. You know, there's not a lot of spread. All of them are saying roughly somewhere in the neighborhood of 200 million people lost their lives due to war during the 1900s. Does it help you understand what Isaiah chapter 59, verse 8 means when he said, "The way of peace they know not"? And yet this is just the beginning. You and I look toward what Mr. Walker talked about last night, Isaiah chapter 2. In Isaiah chapter 2, you know, every minister worries. It's a great privilege to speak, give the first full sermon in the feast, because then you can sit down and not worry about what every other minister is going to do to take the sermon scriptures that you are going to use. You think you're fairly safe on this one, and yet Mr. Walker took all my introduction in his introduction. That's fair play, though. That's the way it goes. We all tell each other, look, no two of us are going to say it the same way, so what difference does it make? Isaiah chapter 2 and verse 4 says, speaking of Jesus Christ, when he returns to establish the kingdom of God on this earth, he shall judge between the nations and shall rebuke many peoples. They shall beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nations shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war anymore. You know, that's fairly all-inclusive, brethren. It's the disbanding of armies, navies, and air forces. It is the obsolescence of all military bases, land, sea, and air. It is the going out of business sign on West Point, Annapolis, the Air Force Academy, and all of the comparable institutions in every other country that has war colleges. And he says, not only will wars cease, but man will simply stop even learning how to wage them. Zechariah chapter 9. Zechariah chapter 9, speaking of the second coming of the Messiah, Zechariah writes in verse 10, I will cut off the chariot from Ephraim and the horse from Jerusalem. The battle bow shall be cut off. He shall speak peace to the nations. His dominion shall be from sea to sea and from the river to the ends of the earth. God is going to teach peace. You know, this by itself, with what I read to you about war in this century, and even the number of wars being waged since the beginning of this century, meaning starting with 2000, this all by itself is probably more than most of us can wrap our minds around. And yet every year we come here to commemorate a reality. The kingdom of God is going to come to this earth, and wars will cease to be fought, the knowledge of war will cease to be taught. This is wonderful. But let me ask you a question. Is this peace? Let's stop and consider something. During the middle of the last century, and I need to set the stage a little bit because this sets the stage for all the rest of the sermon. During the middle of the last century, an American psychologist by the name of Abraham Maslow developed a theory based upon his observations, now called Maslow's hierarchy of needs. Maslow basically watched people. And he said, you know what? If you're cold, you're naked, and you're hungry, you only have one thing on your mind: getting warm and relieving your hunger. He said, that's all you're really going to be concerned about. You don't care. If you're hungry enough, you don't care whether another human being on the face of this earth likes you. If you're cold enough, you really don't care how you look. At that level, you're concerned about one thing. Now, when Maslow created his hierarchy, he said, you know what, but you take care of that. You take care of a person's hunger, you take care of their cold, and they feel confident that they're going to remain fed and they're going to remain warm. You know what happens? They start thinking about something else. They now start thinking about whether they're safe. I'm fed and I'm warm, but is somebody going to come and steal my food? Steal my wood pile? In other words, are they going to steal the things that allow me to feel this way? If a person says, no, my food is secure, my fuel to keep me warm is secure, at that particular point in time, you know what a person does? They start looking around and they start asking, am I right? Do people care about me? Do I fit in somewhere? Do I have buddies? Do I have a family? Do I have a community? You know, at the survival level, you don't worry about community. In fact, you may go to war with community to see that you eat. Well, he simply said, at each level, as you are comfortable there, your mind changes and your attention moves to another level. And he simply created a scale that shows that with each level, if you're comfortable, you think of the next level. I needed to refer to Maslow because when I asked you the question, what is peace? And I said, we live in a society that is numbed. Our comprehension of peace works about the same way as Maslow's hierarchy of needs. In a world that is completely filled with war, about all you can think about is, where is the war going on? You know, we developed a consciousness after September 11 of last year that we are vulnerable in a way that we never felt before. And it created an ill-at-ease state. There are people who don't want to fly now. There are people, on the other hand, like myself, that are very glad for all the inconveniences before I get on the plane. I'd rather not be going through them, but I'd rather have them than the alternative. You know, for the sake of the sermon today, let's ask this question. If all the wars on the planet ceased, would you feel that the world is at peace? Now, for those of you that don't live in this area of the country, what I'm about to say will not be as relevant as it is for those who live in this part of the country. But I can tell you one thing in regards to that question. The question, if all the wars on this planet ceased, would you feel the world would be at peace? I can tell you for Ashley Pond and Miranda Gaddis, the absence of war was of no real consequence. Peace involves more than the absence of war. In one of our governing documents for the United States, there is a lofty goal set. It is the goal of achieving, and I'll use the terms used in the document, It is the goal of achieving domestic tranquility. If all war ceased, you and I would simply turn our eyes into another direction and we would say, you know, it's nice to know that nobody in the world is fighting. There's not a war going on anywhere on this planet. But you know what? I don't feel safe walking in the dark of night through downtown. I never feel safe allowing my children to walk from my house to some other place unescorted or without knowing where they're going, how long they'll be there, and when they're coming back. My evening news, and your evening news too, brethren, focuses as much upon what is going on that is unpeaceful in our community as it does about what's going on somewhere else. You have your network news, and then that is followed or it's preceded by your local news. And what is your local news all about? It's about all the things that are not tranquil in your city. How many cities can you walk in any part of the city at night and feel totally safe? How many cities over a 500,000 metropolitan area could you go anywhere in the city, walk it at night, and not feel the need to look over your shoulder or check the buildings or watch cars that stopped along the street? Probably none. I remember as a college student in London, England, coming out of a theater at Piccadilly Circus Sunday evening. A group of about four or five of us had gone to a film. We'd gone in on the train. We came out of the movie. Most of us were Americans, and we were new enough in the area that we were somewhat oblivious to the nature of London. It was Sunday evening, and we walked to the entrance of the subway, and we found one of the accordion metal gates across it and a padlock on it. And we were all sitting there rather shocked. We found someone. We asked a question. They said, oh, the subway is closed at... And said, well, are there any subways open? They said, well, Victoria Station still has a train that's running. And so we made a dash for Victoria Station and missed the last train out of London. The college campus was 20 miles away. But I remember standing at midnight on Oxford Street in London, England. And the only souls that I could see were those that were part of the party that I was in as we were discussing among ourselves. We were college students, and so as we looked for our shillings and our crowns and our pence, we didn't have enough between all of us to pay for a taxi, and so we were trying to calculate, could we walk 20 miles before class Monday morning? It was a funny feeling, because there was a sense of feeling very safe at that particular time. A year later, I was transferred to the area just outside of Chicago. Chicago was my district headquarters, and learned about a community by the name of Cabrini Green, close to downtown Chicago, into which people of my color didn't go day or night. And then when Mr. Harold Jackson was first visited, he said to the minister who was coming in to see him, let me come out and get you, and let me take you back out. There are countries on our nation's list at airports that are listed by the government as simply unsafe to go to. There are countries where we are having the Feast of Tabernacles, where you don't go out after dark at all for any reason. And if you do, you do so understanding that you place your life in jeopardy. Domestic tranquility. You know, brethren, at this particular point in time, we will not have peace until people, no matter what nation they live in and no matter what country they are in, could walk a street day or night and never fear being accosted. We will not have domestic tranquility until we reach the place where our children are able to be missing from our home without the fear that someone has snatched them and that we will simply find the corpse. I have mentioned at times in local congregations that I have pastored some of the symbols that are a constant reminder to me of what we don't have. One of them, every single one of you has in your pocket. And whether you can see mine or not, it's immaterial. All this says, and it's my car key, by the way, is that I cannot afford not to have this and still own the car. This isn't about starting. I remember as a child working on the farm that some of the old farm trucks simply had a button that you pushed. And you didn't have to have the key to turn the ignition on. Every single one of us has locks on the doors of our house. If you have valuable papers, you keep them in a place that's locked. If they're valuable enough, you may keep them in a bank, or they're inside of a vault, in a safe deposit box. There are security cameras and all of the electronic gizmos necessary for surveillance. I've had the opportunity to go through Hong Kong a few times. It impressed me, Kowloon and Hong Kong are cities that you don't feel in jeopardy at night when you walk some of the streets. And yet I remember going to the apartment of a friend, probably 12 floors up, in a reasonable residential area of Hong Kong. And as we approached the apartment, there was a guard on duty, and the guard guarded an accordion gate that enclosed the entrance to the area where the elevator was housed. And so he had to identify you to let you through. When you got to the elevator, he's standing there, the accordion gate is there, you still had to have a key to open the elevator. We went up 10 floors. I think we were 10 to 12 floors up. We went up 10 to 12 floors. Now, you've already got a physical guard, an accordion gate, and a key to get in the elevator shaft, and yet when we got off the elevator and went to the apartment, there was a literal jailhouse door, meaning the one-inch round bars, all of the metal of a jailhouse door over the front of the door to the apartment that had to first be opened before you inserted the keys in the locks to open the apartment door. We shouldn't have to live like that. I remember the first time I visited the church-owned home in Cape Town, South Africa. You know, if you deal with wish lists and you say, if I could live anywhere on the face of the earth, where would I like to live? For the climate, the scenery, the...